First up this morning is a good friend of ICE who has been a contributor to bringing solid information to our conference and to the industry, Mr. John Gorman. John has a new venture that I'm very excited about. He's the founder and CEO of Nightingale Partners, and he will be talking a little bit more about that, but really focusing on social determinants of health. As you heard Centuria talk earlier, and we all know as we're rolling this forward, a lot of underlying issues related to that particular area, and a lot of opportunity to really come alongside and help folks. And so we're very excited about that. And so with that, I'll bring up our friend, Mr. John Gorman. Thank you.
Thanks again to Mike and the entire organization for having us, and on 21 successful years. I don't know if you all saw Trump the other day at the White House, but I think this whole impeachment process is just making this guy even more batshit crazy than he came into office with. Did you hear the whole toilet discussion? Like, here's from the transcript. We have a situation where we're looking very strongly at sinks and showers and other elements of bathrooms, the president said, where you turn the faucet on in areas where there's tremendous amounts of water, where the water rushes out to sea because you could never handle it, and you don't get any water. You turn on the faucet and you don't get any water. They take a shower and water comes dripping out, just dripping out, very quietly, dripping out. People are flushing toilets 10 times, 15 times, as opposed to once. They end up using more water. You go into a new building or a new house or a new home, and they have standards where you don't get water. You can't wash your hands practically, so little water comes out of the faucet. Is he talking about California? Or is he just talking about Crazy Town? And the end result is you leave the faucet on, and it takes so much longer to wash your hands. For the most part, you have many states where they have so much water it comes down, it's called rain. That's an actual quote. They don't know what to do with it. A lot of things we do are based on common sense. And if I didn't get elected, we wouldn't have a steel industry. Whiskey, tango, foxtrot, friends. And I think as impeachment winds on, it's just going to get worse and worse. And I think the only thing that's wrong with America's toilets is we haven't figured out how to flush this orange turd yet. So thank you. Thank you. Okay. Thank you for getting me the hell out of Washington because, man, it is just, I've never seen it as nuts as it is now. All right. So, man, we got a lot to talk about because our industry is changing and evolving now, it seems, at light speed. We know that Medicare Advantage and Medicaid remain the sole sources of revenue growth for plans, providers, pharmacies, PBMs alike. We know that Medicare Advantage and Medicaid are actually the biggest laboratories on the planet right now for social determinants of health. And that's enabled by new policies, which helped hugely and were a big surprise out of this administration, but also by abundant evidence that I want to review with you guys, because I think a lot of what's impeding us acting boldly in social determinants is the fact that the folks who truly control our health plans are not our charismatic CEOs. They're the chief actuary. And actuaries are having a hard time getting their arms around all this social determinant and anti-poverty stuff. So we'll talk about that a little bit, starting with evidence that will help us make our case inside our companies. These interventions are the only hope that we really have to bend the curve on healthcare expenditures. We know that 60% of healthcare expenditures in the general population are attributable to social determinants, that your zip code determines your healthcare expenditures a hell of a lot more than your own genetic code, and that if we want to have any real hope of bending the curve on what we're spending as a nation in healthcare, we got to do a better job at dealing with poverty. We spend less than 1% of our gross domestic product on our social safety net as opposed to 5 to 7% in other industrialized countries. And so it falls to us, the insurance industry, where we have 100% risk for the patients that we've enrolled to now deal with poverty, where they grew up, what they've breathed their entire lives, what they've drank, what they've eaten, who they've lived with. and things of that sort. And among seniors, social determinants are attributable to over 80% of their healthcare expenditures, because I like to say, in healthcare, poverty charges interest. And that if you live a lifetime of poverty, as our seniors in Medicare Advantage have, many of them, that generally you're going to see a whole lot more of their expenditures attributable to how they live and where they live than anything else. So it's both, as I like to say, guys, here, Darwinian moment. You know, you don't have to be the biggest. You don't have to be the smartest. You just have to be the most adaptable. I'm seeing some of the most incredible innovations in social determinants coming from small, local, regional health plans, and even from large and sophisticated medical groups and health systems that bear risk, as we do out here in the West. And those guys are making giant leaps forward in this industry. One of the examples we'll look at today is Anthem. I don't think anybody ever until this year would have accused Anthem of being an innovator in Medicare Advantage. And yet, under the leadership of Gail Boudreaux, who came in from United's government program shop, so she damn sure knows a whole lot about Medicare Advantage and Medicaid, and then Sachin Jain, who's the amazing CEO and a dear friend who runs CareMore, you saw a complete adaptation of their benefit design around social determinants this year and in 2020, and that's a great example that we want to look at today. Secondly, it's Edisonian, because you guys know my favorite quote by now from Thomas Edison, which is that vision without execution is hallucination. And nowhere is that the case more true than with social determinants of health. That not only can we have big dreams and visions about how to do this, but then we got to execute on these things, guys. And execution in big anti-poverty initiatives like we're going to talk about today requires a whole different skill set than we're used to. It requires a whole new approach to network management. I mean, we're going to be doing business with providers and vendors that most of us have spent our careers running from like scalded dogs, right? You're talking like meal delivery vendors. You're talking about affordable housing developers. You're talking about home modifications companies that will keep people in their homes longer and more independent and safer. So, you know, we really kind of need to rethink the way that we've done our entire business model around a much more holistic approach to our beneficiaries, so that we're realizing execution along with the big visions and plans that we're all going to have. I mean, you guys know this is one of my favorite charts of all time, shows the death spiral of the commercial market and the indelible rise of Medicare Advantage and Medicaid managed care as the country gets older and poorer and fewer employers offer coverage to their employees. We know all about the stunning rise of Medicare Advantage, and that that is going to continue for the foreseeable future. We're on this incredible path right now of average 36% penetration in the program today, with many markets like we see here in California, like we see in Minnesota, like we see in Florida, now approaching 60% penetration and higher in some of these markets like Los Angeles and here in San Francisco and elsewhere. And that growth is expected to continue for the foreseeable future. I think we're going to probably end up this year at around a 9.5% rate of growth. And Medicare Advantage growth is expected to be somewhere between 10 and 11% for the next several years, bringing us to 50% penetration around the end of 2024, okay? And that, of course, is going to be a watershed event, because, you know, we know that Medicare Advantage payment rates are based on historical fee-for-service trends. Well, they got to start rethinking the payment methodology if now we're at 50% penetration, and there's going to be a lot of policy around that. What MedPAC thinks that means is that we're going to see our rates flatten out over this next couple years. Now, that's not to say it's going to zero, not by a damn sight. Those rates are going to continue to grow, but they're not going to grow at the rate that we've seen in this last couple years. In fact, it's going to plateau more around about an 8% annual increase. And when we see that, and recognizing that medical inflation around among the elderly runs at 6 to 7%, you know, we're basically going to see a wash in our rates over this next couple of years. And we all know that up until this point, Medicare Advantage has largely been a revenue game. We, you know, we slug this out on risk adjustment. We fight every day for stars to get over and above 4, so we get the bonus and we get the rebates. Now this is going to necessitate us looking at our MLR for really the first time since the Balanced Budget Act of 98, when the last big round of cuts came through. And again, the only real hope that we've got of bending a curve in our expenditures is going to be to deal boldly with poverty and social determinants of health. We're seeing very similar trends in Medicaid as well. Not many of us are aware, as we should be, that Medicaid now covers 75 million Americans. 1 in 5 Americans is enrolled in Medicaid. This program is paying for 80% of our long-term care bills and pays for more than half of all births in the United States. And we know that those expenditures are largely attributable, about two-thirds of them, to the low-income elderly and the disabled, again, proving the theorem that poverty charges interest in healthcare, and nowhere do you see that more the case than among low-income elders and dual eligibles, as well as the under 65 disabled population, and they account for two-thirds of what Medicaid is spending. And so the duals remain the biggest source of opportunity for health plans. We've got somewhere between 12 to 15 million duals out there, but less than 1 million of them are enrolled in health plans nationally. CMS just put out a big solicitation to get more waivers to come in for enrolling duals in health plans, and I think we're going to see a whole bunch of states take them up on it before this administration leaves office. So again, we're going to be focusing on many of the lowest income and most vulnerable people in the system, and that means we're going to be seeing a whole lot more around managed long-term care and what we refer to as MLTSS, or managed long-term services and supports. And we've got about 37 states that have MLTSS waivers in place, and I think this is going to be one of the most popular areas of Medicaid waivers in the next couple of years, where you're going to start to see 1915B waivers and C waivers to do more home and community-based services, and then, of course, all the financial alignment demos and additional efforts around enrolling duals into health plans. And so that's what brings us back to social determinants and how much of a causation they are in what we spend in our healthcare system every year. I think it's telling that most health systems in the country recognize mastery of social determinants as absolutely key to their survival in this coming decade, with over two-thirds of academic medical centers saying their future is going to lie in mastering this stuff, and 86% of health system execs saying that social determinants are a top three strategic priority. So the providers who are closer to the members than we are typically know how urgent and pressing these issues are. Oh man, the fonts got all screwed up there. Sorry, guys. So it was the CMS policy change last year that really was the watershed event, where the new policy says that you may now include in your bid and in your benefit design those services or benefits which, here's the operative phrase, reduce avoidable emergency and healthcare utilization. That could be almost anything. But it basically says anything that's going to keep people out of ERs unnecessarily, anything that's going to bend the curve on costs and do better preventive care, especially for the chronically ill, is now allowable. The challenges there are, first and foremost, while we love this new policy and the flexibility that it brings, there was no new money included in this. And so it falls on the plans to either use your own currency out of your own treasuries or to find external sources of sustainable capital for these types of benefits. And I'm going to go through two of them today with emphasis on one of them. Secondly, as I mentioned earlier, in-house actuaries, who are the ones who really run our health plans, they are really struggling with getting their arms around anti-poverty benefits. Actuaries are great at pricing out services that occur within the four walls of a provider's office or an institution like a hospital, right? They don't necessarily have a great frame of reference for how do we price out a meal delivery service for our uncontrolled diabetics, or home modifications or pest control for our asthmatics and folks with respiratory illnesses and things of that sort. And we don't really yet know, or the actuaries will say, we don't yet really know what the effect of a lot of these types of interventions are. And that's absolutely not the case. There is a wealth of evidence out there that these types of interventions bear huge fruit in healthcare savings, and we'll get at that in just a second. But I mean, the reason we're in the middle of an arms race right now is because I think everybody has awakened to the fact that this stuff makes sense, and the returns on these types of investments are staggering. So as a result, we're seeing big market leaders in the space in heavy transactional activity around this stuff. Kaiser and United investing more than $400 million each in social determinants just this year. Unite Us got a big round of funding. Solera got $42 million in a Series C with the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association's venture group. 14 health systems 2 weeks ago came together to invest $700 million in social determinants in this coming year. And we're just seeing deals all over the place, like Centene acquiring WellCare. That wasn't just to get a presence in a couple of additional states and take out a competitor. They were buying WellCare's Community Connections, which was their whole social determinants platform with about 1,100 people in it that did nothing but help sign members up for existing social welfare programs they were already entitled to. And then they executed 45,000 contracts with social determinants vendors in their 17 states, and they managed this non-professional, non-clinical network of social determinants providers as a result. That was as much an emphasis of this transaction between Centene and WellCare as it was buying up health plans. So let's look at the evidence, and let's get around this idea that these are unproven benefits that we're not really quite sure what we're investing in, because there is a wealth of research out there that shows this is the absolute focus and where we should be putting our money and attention into. Housing and home safety are among the most beneficial in terms of reducing healthcare expenditures among the folks who need housing and who are housing insecure. We know that, especially among seniors, housing insecurity is approaching crisis proportions. And we know that one-third of seniors fall every year, largely attributable to hazards in the home. Not just, you know, carpets and cords and stuff, but just uneven surfaces that can cause a fall. I mean, I like to say that most seniors are only one fall away from long-term care. And that's true. And over 75, a broken hip translates into a death sentence for over half of them. Okay? And so dealing with home modifications and housing insecurity can be some of the most impactful investments that we make. But they also take the longest time to market, because building new housing stock takes a long time. So we have to get creative about this stuff going forward. But we know the results are there. I mean, in New York City, they found a 91% decline in emergency department visits among those who received housing services for asthmatics. So you got a kid or a senior who's living in a damp, moldy basement, as many of them do, just putting in a dehumidifier has staved off millions of unnecessary ER visits and hospitalizations as a result. Los Angeles County, where we're doing a massive project right now to try to figure out how to house 31,000 members of LA Care who are homeless and housing insecure. 10 years ago, they found that people who are homeless with stable housing literally cost taxpayers 79% less than their homeless counterparts who remained on the street. Anthem in Indiana found that some transitional housing for folks coming out of institutions and hospitalizations yielded an $872 per member per month savings. And UPMC in Pittsburgh saved $6,400 per member per year net of costs in a housing program for folks with multiple comorbidities and serious polypharmacy issues. And net of all those costs, it was a $6,400 per member per year savings. All right, so just huge stuff there. The research consensus is that healthcare costs for those in supportive and transitional housing are reduced by almost 60%, that emergency room costs decreased by 61%, and that general inpatient hospitalizations are decreased by 77%. You want to bend the curve on what you're spending, especially in Part A, start dealing with housing insecurity. One of the most impactful things we can do for our members is just as simple as helping them enroll in other welfare benefit programs they're already entitled to, primarily among them, Medicaid. So for Medicare Advantage beneficiaries, we know there's a whole lot of folks out there who are dually eligible and not yet signed up. Getting them on Medicaid is literally the single best thing you can do for them, not to mention the revenue bump that it brings you once you flick on that Medicaid indicator in the plan file. But then, beyond that, signing people up for low-income heating assistance, for housing subsidies, for food stamps, even though Trump, in his infinite wisdom and compassion, is about to cut 4 million people off of food stamps before Christmas. What a guy. But just getting seniors signed up for food stamps and food assistance can be one of the most impactful things that you do for these folks. The centerpiece of any good social determinant intervention is community health workers. All of the research shows that any type of intervention you're doing with low-income people is going to be furthered dramatically by the involvement and the presence of community health workers. These are basically social workers without the MSW. They live in these underserved communities. They know their way around, and they are paneled to your highest risk, most expensive members to help serve as navigators through the health system, to help them take their medications correctly, to sign them up for all the other social welfare benefit programs that they're entitled to. The results are pretty staggering in terms of savings per year, decreased utilization, and improved quality, not to mention what these folks do to your star rating. Okay? Remember, the biggest drag on your star rating is dual eligibility and low income status, right? Well, what do you think happens with those low income folks who are generally sick, depressed, and whenever the CAHPS surveyors call up, they shit all over you because they're generally unhappy with their state of life, right? But now they've got a community health worker. They've got an advocate. They've got a defender. They've got a guide through the system for them. Now they're singing your praises from the rooftops when the CAP surveyors call. The results that you see in some of the surveys from members that have a CHW assigned to them are just unbelievable in terms of the results there. Transportation. Now, a lot of us think this is pretty straightforward and simple. It is not. Transportation benefits guys are fraught with peril. This is not as simple as calling up Uber or Lyft and saying, we want to do a deal with you guys to get our patients to their doctor's appointments. They've had very mixed results with both of those companies because these are not typical folks like us in a room taking an Uber or Lyft. All the mischief in a Medicare and Medicaid population happens between the bedroom and the curb. And trying to get these folks to the vehicle and in and out of it is where all the problems occur. And when transportation benefits are not done right, they are a huge source of complaints and end up in the complaint files with CMS. So you got to be very careful in how you structure these to ensure that the drivers are trained in mobility issues and helping very frail people get to and from the vehicle into the appointment, that they're waiting for them, that they're doing everything that they need to ensure that that happens safely. But when it's done right, this is an enormous source of savings. I mean, it's thought that $37 billion in healthcare expenditures are attributable just to missed doctor's appointments. And who needs to see the doctor the most but our seniors, who are seeing an average of 26 encounters in the outpatient setting every year. And if they're transportation challenged, guys, that means they're missing care that they should be getting, okay? Food security. Man, this is one of my all-time favorites. Here's why. 2 years ago, Geisinger had one of the most landmark studies that we've seen yet in Pennsylvania. They found they were spending almost $280,000 a year on their uncontrolled diabetics per patient per year. $280,000 per patient per year on uncontrolled diabetics. So they started a medically appropriate meal delivery service for them. Within 14 months, they dropped that down to $48,000 per patient per year for a net savings of almost $200,000 per patient per year. The net cost of the meals delivered was about $8 per meal. Okay? That's a 35x return on investment. Okay? There is no place anywhere else that you will see those kind of returns on any investment anywhere. Even, I mean, God, even sinking money into a marijuana dispensary out here with a brownie shop next door, you couldn't do better than that. And we know this is just a crushing issue for seniors. I mean, one out of three seniors is food insecure. These are folks that are making choices between food and medicine every day. And let me tell you guys, in the last 2 weeks of the month, when that Social Security check at about $1,200 a month starts running down, these are folks making decisions between insulin or am I eating cat food in order to take my medicine, okay? This is one of the most impactful things that we can possibly do for our members with some of the greatest impact on healthcare expenditures. And it's just so simple, just feeding people and recognizing the presence of food deserts in the underserved communities where these folks typically live, that recognizing that in many of these neighborhoods, the only place you can go to get groceries is either the corner bodega or a drugstore. And chances are they're going to find nothing better than canned soup on the shelf. And man, if you've got congestive heart failure and you eat a can of condensed soup with that sodium, you're in the hospital that afternoon. So ameliorating food deserts, making food more available for those who are homebound or transportation challenged to deliver it to them, and doing medically appropriate meal delivery for those with ambulatory sensitive conditions like diabetes, chronic kidney disease, and the like, has an enormous impact, outsized impact, on their healthcare expenditures. Loneliness and social isolation. We tend to poo-poo that in this big, rough, and tough country of ours. But we've found lately that, especially among seniors, being lonely and isolated is the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And that somebody who is lonely or isolated, as half of all seniors reported being in the last month, it leads to a much higher incidence of depression. And we know depression is a 4x multiplier of the cost of any other chronic condition that may be present. So a depressed, uncontrolled diabetic is going to be 4 times as expensive as a happy, uncontrolled diabetic. Okay? So heading off depression, and here's the pink elephant in the living room of our industry, guys. They're all depressed. Almost all seniors are blue at some point. I mean, this was so bad that earlier this year, you may have seen, the Brits did a survey of all their seniors and found that one quarter of all British seniors reported not having had a single adult conversation in the prior 30 days. 25%. And the numbers are identical here. Can you imagine what that's like? I mean, I think we all are aware that in the correction system, sticking somebody in solitary basically is going to lead to a crazy-ass inmate after a matter of weeks, right? That's what many of our seniors are living with on a daily basis. So something as simple as getting people out for a mall walk or a community event or popping up a beautiful, gleaming adult daycare center in the middle of that community for them to come and spend the day in and maybe give their caregivers a rest is like gold for many seniors. So to compile some of the evidence, these are some of the results that we've seen in our, you know, pretty exhaustive search of the research. And, you know, you've got just enormous prevalence of these challenges in the populations that we serve, and just enormous opportunity, as you see there on the right, by intervening on their behalf to deal with this stuff more effectively. Now, some guiding principles for how we approach social determinants. We have not seen a whole lot of innovation out of our industry yet around these benefits. A lot of excitement, a lot of buzz, but not a whole lot of motion yet, as I'll show you the data in a minute. So we should have some guiding principles as we approach this stuff, right, that just makes sense. One is these benefits should be clear and easy to understand. They should be targeted to those in the greatest need. That's a big, big challenge, guys, because most of us do not screen for social determinants yet. It means we have very little data available to us to figure out who are the members who need this stuff the most. So you got to get really creative with your data scientists to figure out how to put your fingers on this population. So for instance, down at LA Care, the 31,000 people that we're working to house, one of the biggest and most vulnerable cohorts of that 31,000, as it turned out, are foster kids. I didn't know this at all. But when foster kids hit 18 years old, they get emancipated. Almost all of their foster homes put them out on the street. At 18 years old, with no skills, no place to go, no family, no support network. In Los Angeles County, 80% of foster kids become homeless on day one. 6 months later, that number has persisted, and now the prevalence of substance abuse disorder and trafficking among that population is epidemic. So we're trying to figure out, how do we house our foster kids once they become emancipated at 18? We've got precious little data to figure out how to find these kids. So we're going to have to go hit the street to find them. So that's a big limiter and something that we really need to start working on immediately so that we can figure out where the need is greatest and how to target these interventions. They got to be designed to be manageable and, very importantly, most importantly, sustainable. And first and foremost, that pertains to financing. We got to have a stable source of money to fund these types of interventions and benefits. And they've got to evolve with experience and data supporting their effectiveness, because if we don't have that, you're not going to have a whole lot of consensus behind continuing to offer these benefits over the long term. So let's look and see what we're doing as an industry. I got to say, for year one of this in 2019, yeah, it's not a whole lot to really be spiking the football over. What most of the plans did this year is really just a continuation or an expansion of stuff we were all doing 2 years ago anyway. So the biggest jump that we saw was in over-the-counter drug benefits. Okay, we're now two-thirds of plans are offering an OTC benefit, many of them tying it as sort of like an incentive to healthy behavior. So if you're a diabetic, you take your insulin flawlessly for 30 days straight, we'll give you a $100 over-the-counter drug discount card, and you can go to CVS or wherever to use it. You saw a big increase in non-emergency transportation, a big increase in meals, though it was pretty modest benefit, and a big uptake in emergency response systems like the I've fallen and I can't get up little button you wear around your neck, okay? Most of the plans, as I said, focused on just expanding stuff that they were doing already. Very few embraced next-gen social determinants benefits. You know, we saw some nicotine replacement therapy, so now more and more plans offering patches for smokers that want to quit. Little more support for family caregivers. But I think it really spoke to the question of, we got to find a way to finance these services over the long term. The vast majority of our plans either do not have the money on hand to invest in big new benefits like this, or two, they're afraid of investing their own money because if it's your money, then it's going to impact premium, right? Anytime you're spending your money on new benefits, and CMS didn't give us any new money to pay for it, then that means there's going to be an impact to premium. And here again, the actuaries chime in and say, well, wait a minute. Our whole basis of competition in our market is a zero premium product. If we do a meal delivery benefit for all of our diabetics, it's going to be like a $4 per member per month charge, and we no longer have a zero premium. We can't do that. I mean, we may want to feed all of our diabetics as much as we do, but we can't affect our competitive position like that. That's the biggest impediment, I think, to acting boldly around social determinants. So now we've got to find external sources of capital to help pay for this stuff. Here's the Anthem example of innovation and of one of the smaller companies in the space leaping forward in terms of its innovation around these benefits. Look at what Anthem put on the street this year. In 14 different states, they're offering up to 16 home-delivered meals per health event, up to 64 per year. They're offering 60 trips to doctor's appointments, up to 124 hours of home health support. It's not a lot. Runs out to about 2.5 hours of home health support a week. But it's something, and it's a start. And what they're doing is using it to collect data on which of their members need it the most. A $500 allowance for home safety modifications, including pest control. It's really cool. And a couple of other bells and whistles, right? So this has got Gail Boudreau and Sachin Jain's fingerprints all over it. You never saw anything this innovative out of Anthem before the two of them were on the scene. Let's look at what everybody else was doing for this coming year. Again, over-the-counter benefits, drug benefits become table stakes. Now we've got 80% of the nationals, 50% of the blues, 47% of provider-owned plans are carrying an over-the-counter drug benefit. 64% of the nationals, 22% of blues, and 28% of provider-sponsored plans offering a meal benefit. Transportation has gone mainstream in 2020 as well. So we're starting to see some really interesting stuff there. We're seeing a big increase in eye and hearing exams for next year. But then what's interesting is that among the stuff that's discussed the most, you see far less of it. Again, less innovation than we'd like to see and less uptake and availability of these benefits to more of our members. So a comprehensive dental benefit. So now I think we can all start to conclude that vision, hearing, dental, and over-the-counter drug benefits are the new table stakes starting in 2020. In our benefit design. So we've got to get there at an absolute minimum. And then you see some of the other services that some of the plans are offering. And then for the really creative stuff, you know, you're seeing a big uptick in plans offering acupuncture, therapeutic massage. We're seeing an uptake among a couple of hundred plans in bathroom safety devices. And pest control, I thought, was one of the more innovative benefits for next year. In 2021 is when I think we'll start to see some new trends emerge. But first, you know, I think what we'll really start to see, because this will be the first real year in 2020, 2021 is really going to be where I think a lot of this stuff goes big. And I think if you're struggling with where to start with social determinants, as many plans are, I think one of those guiding principles has first got to be, as Sachin Jain likes to say, radical common sense. One of the first things that's always characterized our industry is copayments and deductibles, right? Skin in the game, as actuaries and Republicans like to say. And the thing is it's not skin. This is money largely for people on fixed incomes or low-income people, poor people outright. And it's not a game. This is people's health care. And to say that, well, we've always done it this way with copayments and deductibles just doesn't buy it anymore, okay? We need to recognize that copayments and deductibles are economic barriers to access. That's what they represent. What sense does it make to charge a low-income dual a $20 copayment for a primary care visit when we know she needs to see the doctor at least 24 times a year, okay? Makes no sense. Why are we charging copayments of 25, 50 bucks, putting insulin on tier 2 or 3 of a freaking formulary? I mean, if this is a life-saving medication that keeps people out of hospitals and keeps them from getting their left foot amputated, why the hell would we put a cost bump like that in front of them to getting it? It just makes absolutely no sense. So some radical common sense as it comes to copayments and deductibles. I think we'll see the beginning of tiered supplemental benefit designs. So Anthem did that 124 hours of home health this year, right? I think in 2021, you're going to start to see things like we see in the Obamacare exchanges. You're going to see silver, gold, platinum level benefits, bronze, silver, gold, whatever, that says, look, if you need 2,000 hours of home health care a year, and there are lots of seniors out there who do, then you'll be able to get that with our platinum product, say for 17 bucks a month as a rider, okay? We talked about the new table stakes being vision, dental, hearing, and OTC. And in 21 is when I think we'll start to see some of the really interesting stuff begin to emerge, like medication-assisted opioid treatment. We're doing a lot of that stuff at Nightingale now. You'll start to see a lot of stuff around polypharmacy, mental and behavioral health access. My hope is that we're going to start to see adult daycare centers popping up on every corner like freaking mushrooms. They are wonderful facilities to have. They are great for caregiver respite. You can't believe the CAHPS survey results that you see from folks that have accessed an adult daycare center in the last year. I mean, all of this stuff is really wonderful. And you see similar movement in Medicaid as well as we are seeing in Medicare Advantage. I mean, we've got 40 states addressing it now through their program amendments. 35 out of 39 states now require their plans to screen for social determinants and make referrals to services, and a whole lot more emphasis on data collection and effectiveness. Medicaid is always really important for us if you're in Medicare Advantage to look to because, man, this is there every day. I mean, all they deal with is low-income, vulnerable people, whereas, you know, it's a fraction of our population, but a big one in Medicare Advantage. So we want to watch what's happening there as, you know, some indication of what we should expect to see in Medicare Advantage 2 to 3 years from now. And as I mentioned, guys, this means we've got an all-new normal in how we do network management within our plans in this new age. We are going to really have to start to get the folks down in provider relations, just like we have to start acclimating our actuaries to this new world. We got to get network management used to the idea of how do we go about doing business with a mom-and-pop home modifications company that does ramps and bumpers and railings and pest control and stuff like that, when they've basically been doing this stuff either off of grants, off of philanthropy, and now we want to get them on a path to a value-based contract. That's going to require a whole new set of approaches, skill sets, and new contracting representatives to go out and deal with these types of folks, okay? So, again, these are often providers that we've spent running from for most of our careers because we associated them with adverse selection. And now here they are, our best friends that we have to
really find a new and exciting ways of doing business with, and recognizing that, you know, especially for like meal delivery, you know, if it's not Meals on Wheels or it's not the Lutheran Society or Catholic Charities, it's probably a half dozen lovely church ladies in a basement somewhere who have never signed a contract for what they do ever. They just do it out of the goodness of their hearts and maybe a grant from the local area agency on aging or something to that effect. We've got to help them become businesswomen with an actual venture that we can ultimately get to a value-based contract with to govern their performance, okay? So we talked some about the barriers here. I want to spend the remainder of our time talking about sustainable financing for these types of benefits. External sources of capital basically break down to two for what we're talking about here, friends. One is social impact bonds. I spent about 3.5 or 4 years trying to figure out if social impact bonds were the way to go for financing these types of benefits, and I found it was pretty disappointing. I had probably 45 meetings with bond financiers that do social impact, and they just don't get healthcare nearly as easily as some of the other folks that I've come to. There's about $50 billion in social impact bonds out there in the U.S. this calendar year. And for months, I just didn't even look at opportunity zones because they came out of Trump's big tax giveaway bill in 2017. And I was like, come on, man, this thing was Jared Kushner's idea so he could get cheap capital for his slums in Baltimore. I don't want to look at that. And then when I finally got frustrated enough with the social impact bond guys, I looked at it again, and then these new regs came out in April that changed everything, and I was like, holy shit, this is it. Opportunity zones say in the tax law that they designated about 9,000 zip code tracts across the U.S. that are both economically disadvantaged and medically underserved, and they said if you invest money in these zip codes, that capital is exempt from, and leave it in for at least 10 years, that capital is exempt from capital gains, and all of the proceeds and profits that that investment makes in that opportunity zone are completely tax-free. Holy crap. I mean, that's like porn for Republicans. And then people like us who are looking for sustainable sources of capital. Guys, this opened up a gusher of over $6 trillion with a T in available capital, okay? And as I said, they get the maximum tax benefit if they leave the money in for 10 years. So it suits our purposes perfectly for long-term puts into new social determinants, infrastructure, services, and benefits, because that's where they get the greatest tax benefit from. Now, those opportunity zones were determined by governors and by municipalities. So here's some examples that you see here in California of the opportunity zones are in green. And so you see most of downtown LA, most of downtown Sacramento, most of downtown San Diego are all designated opportunity zones, okay? And that means that if you were to start an opportunity zone fund or partner with one like ours and establish a joint venture, base that joint venture in one of the opportunity zones in your service area, all of the capital that flows through that joint venture is now allowable. You can use opportunity zone capital for anything, basically, this thanks to the April regs, anything except buying debt. So you can use it to purchase real estate. You can use it for leases. You can use it for working capital to establish new businesses or to fund existing businesses. You can use it to meet business requirements. One of the things we're going to be funding is the first public option plan in the state of Colorado, okay? And we had an interaction with the IRS a couple weeks ago where we said, can we use opportunity zone capital for the statutory reserves of a startup health plan, and they freaking said yes. So now we're going to have a completely OZ-funded, the first public option plan of its kind in the country in Colorado, thanks to this new flexibility. Basically anything but debt is an allowable use of this capital. So we would work with you, or the way you would approach this yourself, if you're going to go it alone, is that you first identify the populations that you want to go after first. You know, we want to make this available and target the populations who need it the most. Then going to use analytics to identify the specific members for intervention, like the foster kids we're looking for in LA. Then you're going to have a Qualified Opportunity Zone Fund, or a QOF. So there's the latest addition to your alphabet soup in government health programs, is going to be a QOF, or a Qualified Opportunity Zone Fund. Then invest the capital in a QOZB, a Qualified Opportunity Zone Business. Okay? And that's where all the money gets dispersed for whatever social determinant intervention you decided to invest in. So then you execute on that, you measure it, you improve it. Then what we do is we use a shared savings approach with our client to repay our investors over the course of that 10 years. So we partner with Medicare Advantage, Medicaid plans, and capitated provider groups, because what we're doing is monetizing the medical savings that result from these interventions. Remember the Geisinger example, a 35x ROI that returned almost $200,000 per patient per year. That's more than enough to repay the investors with a nice return. And remember, these are, and I just love that we hacked a Republican billionaire tax shelter to do this. I mean, it just gives me more satisfaction than almost anything, that I'm taking money that from folks who put Trump in office, and we're now going to be using it to invest in exactly the people that this administration has left behind. I just love that we're doing that. But they're in it primarily for the tax shelter. The return that they get is a secondary concern for them. So it's relatively cheap capital. And because we're throwing off so much in medical savings, the important thing is it allows us to continually expand these benefits for more and more of our members as time goes by and the more money that we save. Okay, so because most social determinants interventions have at least a 3 to 8x ROI, I mean, the Geisinger thing at 35x is like, you know, that's like fantasy territory. But 3 to 8x is typical and very conservative estimate around what many of these things return. That means most of these interventions are going to be self-sufficient within 4 to 5 years. And that means you're using the proceeds and the savings to continually expand this over 10 years. So this is sustainable financing, and it's cheap capital for these types of benefits. So the value proposition to investors is tremendous, because they're getting a long-term tax shelter, they're getting a good rate of return, and they're getting, for those who care about it, which not many of them do, arguably, a quantifiable social impact. For the plans, we're helping to de-risk the offering of these benefits. We're using other people's money to pay for these interventions, for this infrastructure, and for these programs and benefits. So it takes all the risk out of this for the plan. It doesn't impact your competitive position or your premium, because it's external capital, and it accelerates your savings. And to the beneficiaries, it's helping them access these new benefits and services much quicker than if we left this to the industry's own devices. So to give you guys a sense of where we're going with this, our first tranche is running about $70 million. 44 million of it we've already got committed. So we've got four projects rolling right now in four of our big priority areas. So community health workers, homelessness, diabetic meals, and transportation. And as you can see, the shared savings that we're looking at for years 4 and 5, and those are savings that are resulting on an annual basis at that point, you can see what a tremendous investment these are for the Republican billionaires, but also for the plans that we're partnering with to do this stuff. So I just tend to think that this this 3 years I spent trying to figure out where do we get the money to do this from has borne some fruit, and that, you know, look, you guys know my politics. This was the biggest surprise of my career to find that we could hack a Republican billionaire tax shelter to help pay for one of the biggest developments in our industry in at least a generation.